Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways. We Have Ways listeners, it's your Thursday special edition. We're going to go bite size on this one. It's just a juicy nugget. James is writing his book. He's locked away in a secret location that cannot be revealed except for the last two podcasts. You're writing about Sicily. Now, first things first, is that it's an interesting. Sicily is often one of those things that like doesn't get the full kind of go over, because it's a stepping stone, isn't it? It's one of the operations that the Allies do that isn't a clinching moment in itself, or seen as such, is it? Or decisive moments in itself. It's basically a getting from A to B.
Yeah.
And you'll often read about it like kind of in passing. I mean, very often you read about Tunisia in passing, that you get El Alamein as the big sort of showbiz battle, second Alamein that ends. Effectively puts the seal on the war in the desert. It doesn't end it, but puts the seal on it. And then, of course, the first army turn up. You've got a great big thing going on, right? Anyway, I mean, I think it's all quite interesting. So the point I'm making is Sicily doesn't often find itself under the spotlight like this, does it?
That's reflected in publishing. I mean, it is quite interesting how publishing works, because, of course, you know, there's lots of books on the Battle of Britain, lots of books on D-Day and so on. And, you know, I've been there and done that and got the T-shirt. But I've been to Sicily a lot. And I've been to Sicily actually a couple of times, a few times with the army. You know, they still occasionally do these, what they used to call staff rides, they now just call battlefield studies. And yeah, it's fascinating going to these places with guys who obviously, and a lot of them have seen quite a lot of action, you know, whether it be in Iraq or Afghanistan and so on. And so the weird thing about Sicily particularly is a lot of the terrain is not massively dissimilar to certain parts of Helmand province, and having been there, and you've been there as well, you kind of know it's sort of craggy and rocky and mountainous, and there's little green bits, and you know, but it is really interesting. So it's very, very interesting hearing their take on it. And as you know, kind of one of my big sort of thesis on the Second World War is that generally when it comes to the narrative of it, it's been told in only two of the three levels of war. So that you've got the three levels of war, the strategic, tactical and operational. Yeah. And the strategic is very obvious. That's your kind of overall aims, what you're trying to do. The tactical is the coalface of war. That's the guy in his Spitfire, the crew in their tank, you know, PFC, Schultz in his foxhole outside San Lo. It's that actual kinetic bit. The operational bit is what kind of binds the two together. It's what enables you to have your realistic strategic vision and enables you to fight in a way that you can. It's what decides your way of war, your modus operandi. And on its basic level, it's the economics of war, but it's the nuts and bolts.
It's the delivery of it, isn't it? It's how the tactical delivers the strategic is the operation.
Bang on, yeah, exactly that. And it's basically been left out of the narrative. So if you read most books about the Second World War, a lot of them will have, and particularly kind of popular narratives of them, you'll get an awful lot about what it's like being in Eisenhower's headquarters. You'll get a fantastic window on his character or Patton's or Monty's or whoever it might be, and Churchill and the political leaders as well. And you'll get a fantastic overview of what it was like being on the ground, being in your half track or whatever. But you don't get that middle bit. You don't get that operational level, and you don't see how it works. And actually, the operational level enables you to see all sorts of connections and threads which are otherwise blind to you. You know, about how it works, about how the Battle of the Atlantic is affecting what is going on in the Battle of Alamein, or what is happening in the Far East, or how the Far East is affecting what is going on in Norway or something like that. You know, all these threads that you can only really understand that through a study of the operational level. And the operational level also tells you kind of how they're doing it. And you know, we were talking about this on the last pod about the kind of, you know, the amazing supply efforts, that capacity to kind of build bridges, you know, 23 and 26 nights in Operation Diadem, or you know, building an airfield on Gozo Island off Malta, you know, in a matter of days by the Americans. You know, that's the operational level. And once you insert that, things start to look a little bit different. The last major work, there's been a number of works on Sicily, but the last major narrative history was by Carlo d'Este, who is this retired American colonel who, by all accounts, is a lovely fellow. I've never met him. And, you know, he's been incredibly influential. You know, Decision in Normandy, and his book on the Italian campaign, his book on Sicily. You know, they've been incredibly important books, but they don't include the operational level at all. And so they're just, it's just, how did they fight? You know, and so when Carlo d'Este sees 8th Army struggling through the Catania Plain, all he just goes is, they're a bit slow, you know. Or he looks at the planning, 9 different, you know, permutations of the planning. God, what was their problem? You know, and sometimes you need to just take a massive step back and look at it from a wider prism and a broader prism.
And what the operational is always a reflect, you know, I mean, strategic is often a reflection of politics, after all. But operational stuff can be too, because after all, if you're making operational decisions about where you need an army, then you're making decisions about where food's going to go, which means food can't be somewhere else. And you get into this sort of economic thing of opportunity costs and all that sort of stuff, that, well, if we spend the shipping here, we haven't got it for there, which is, after all, what happens to the Italian campaign. The reason they can't sort of bunny hop their way up the coast,
they just don't have enough shipping.
The ships don't, which is the thing we talked about with Gary a few weeks ago. The ships don't exist.
Yeah, and they do exist, but they're in the Far East, or they're being
they're in the Far East. They've got somewhere else to be, and they're literally going all over the world, getting the ships to where they need them, and that takes months. And if they're on the water, they're not doing their job.
Yes, and if you've got a landing ship that's been in Salerno or Anzio, and then you then bring it back to Britain, that's got to be towed or sailed, shipped all the way around through the length of the Mediterranean, up into the Atlantic and into Liverpool or Greenock or Southampton or Falmouth or wherever it's going to go to. And then it's got to have a major overhaul, because it's absolutely knackered by the time it's done that level of journey, because this is a flat bottom boat, 100 metres long, which has a draft of kind of, you know, 4 foot 8 inches. Yeah. So it's just not designed for ocean going. So that then needs an overhaul. Then you've got to train people to actually do the loading, manning it, operating it, landing it on a beach and all the rest of it. And all that takes time, which is why by doing Anzio, they have to push Overlord back by a month.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and of course, why, they don't do simultaneous landings in north and southern France when Overlord starts, which was the plan all along, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sledgehammer and all that. They have to sack it off, because even though the Allies are massively preponderant in terms of resources, it isn't infinite.
No, it's absolutely not infinite.
Which brings you back to the how clever the operation is, because after all, they're having to make these decisions. It's not just fighting a luxurious war where they can do whatever they like. There's some tough decisions, tough calls to be made along the way.
Indeed, but the thing is with Sicily is two things. So when you're wandering around Sicily, it is even today, it is a very, very tough place in which to just travel around and just view. It's kind of, in high summer, it looks bleached and it's just a sort of toughness and hardness about Sicily. And, you know, you go into the plains and around Catania and stuff, and you see that and you think, okay, there's lots of sort of little water features here and rivers and gullies and dikes and all sorts of stuff that you've got to get across. And you can think, well, that'd be difficult. And then you go to all these kind of hilltop towns, which the Germans go to. And one of the reasons the Germans go to is because, A, obviously they've got amazing observation from up there, but also that's where the roads lead. The roads lead from one town to another, and they just wiggle their way up the next hill. So from the point of view of the attackers, you're standing on one hill and you think, oh, bloody hell, that was a tough fight. I finally got rid of that, you know, finally cleared that hill. And then you look ahead and a kind of sort of 4 miles away is another one, and another 10 miles beyond that is another one, and another one, and another one. And then there's Etna, and you've got to get the other side of Etna before you can get to Messina. I mean, it must have been so demoralising. And you look at, you can stand on the top of Ossoro, for example, and you look at that and you think, okay, they captured this place, this entire island, which is 150 miles wide, in 38 days. And you go, that has got to be pretty good going. One of the big black marks about Sicily is the fact that so many men got away. You know, something like 39,000 Germans, I think 60,000, 80,000 Italians, plus about 10,000 vehicles, something like that. You know, and that's the big black mark. They got away. But the interesting thing about it is if you look at evacuations in the Second World War, they're nearly always successful. I mean, nearly every single one, everyone gets away, starting with Dunkirk, but I can also think about the evacuation of Greece, the evacuation of Crete. I mean, you know, they are pretty successful. And the final thing, of course, is, you know, 39,000 German troops and 10,000 kit, that is not going to make the difference in Italy.
And what was the expected time to capture the island? What was the D plus? Were they on schedule, ahead of schedule, behind schedule?
Yeah, no, they end up being ahead of schedule. I mean, they're kind of sort of, you know, what they're hoping is that they get on really quickly and just hustle through and get onto Catania and then go straight up the east coast to Messina, and it's kind of, you know, done and buried, and they do it in 10 days. But that is absolute kind of best case scenario. I think most people are, I think it's a 60 day, I think they're expecting it to take.
Right.
And one of the reasons is because they front load, you know, Montgomery insists on front loading 8th Army's landings largely with infantry, so they've got a lot of it, just in case the defence by the Sicilians and Germans of Sicily is much harder than they anticipate. And that has to be the right decision, because it's exactly the same with Operation Overlord. The most important thing when you're mounting the world's largest amphibious
is
invasion
that it
ever,
works.
Yeah, or conversely, that it doesn't fail. I mean, that is just inconceivable at that point. You know, nothing can be taken for chance, which means you've got to be overcautious. And because they front-loaded with infantry, in actual fact, the landings are much more successful and much easier than they anticipate, which is great. So nothing wrong with that. But consequently, they haven't got as many vehicles on shore quickly in the first D plus 1 plus 2 plus 3 as they might have done if they'd been, you know, slightly less on infantry and heavier on mechanisation, which then means they've got to basically go by foot to the Catania plain, which, of course, takes time. And there's only certain roads that you can use, and those are quite easy to block, which the Germans do, which then means that by the time they get into the Catania plain, the Germans have reorganised themselves and they've created the Hauptkampflinie, which is the kind of sort of main defence line, all around the kind of foot of Mount Etna, overlooking the plain, where all their guns have got the eyes on anything that moves in the Catania plain. And consequently, it just turns into a slogging match. But you can't criticise Montgomery for that. You know, that's just the nature of the beast. That's the nature of having kind of front-loaded the invasion in the way it was, which quite clearly is the correct decision, not least because so many of the objections that originally put to Montgomery's plan are neutralised by the amazing effort of the Allied air power.
And it's actually a really good... they've kind of found the right template for what then becomes... D-Day.
You cannot overestimate the lessons learned from Sicily.
Because I think it's always really interesting when people talk about Overlord. They get really hung up on Dieppe, on the Dieppe raid. You go, you know, because that's
Dieppe
the,
tells
that's
you
the last. That's the last time anyone. Well, no, you can't take a port and all that. You know, but people always focus on Dieppe rather than, well, hang on a minute, only a year before, there's this great big thing that happens.
One of the big things that they learn from Sicily is that you can't have people running operations and planning at the same time. You need to separate the two.
So
what happens for Overlord is that Eisenhower and Montgomery and the airmen, Spatz and all the rest of it, they're all kind of taken out of the Mediterranean and sent back to England to plan just for Overlord. So their minds are fully focused on the job rather than kind of hurtling around the front in Tunisia whilst at the same time trying to then hurtle back to Algiers for a meeting with Force 141 and all the rest of it. You know, and it's just a terrific story because it's got everything you could possibly want. It's got naval power, it's got air power, it's got tussles with Spitfires and Messerschmitts, it's got heavy bombers, it's got special forces, it's got Paddy Maine and the special raiding squadron, it's got glider operations, it's got our friend Jim Gavin, it's got mad German it's got Falsham
and
Jaeger.
When's it in the shop?
It's got the lot. It's even got Canadians.
It's got Canadians. Brilliant. Well, thanks very much. We hope you've enjoyed our Thursday nugget. You better get back to Syracuse.
I had. Yeah. Actually, they haven't even landed yet, if I'm completely honest.
Thanks for listening, everyone. See you next time. Cheerio.
Cheerio.
Hello, listeners. It's Anita Arnanth here from the Goalhanger sister podcast, Empire, which I host along with...
me, William Dalrymple. And we are here to tell you about our new series on the Founding Fathers, the men who made America.
We wanted to look at the men who actually founded the country, who dreamt the dream, who wrote the words upon which a country would be born. What were they like? What made them do what they did? What did they actually believe in? And how did they come to play the role that they did in the American Revolution and the creation of America?
What really interested me about this was the contradictions. I mean, we expect these men to be great figures. We've seen the portraits in the galleries. We know the faces from the banknotes. But they're deeply complex figures. But in that, and in that blend of contradiction and intellectual power and writing genius and curiosity and raw ability, lies the nuance and complexity that allows us to understand them. And the United States is in many ways a reflection of them, their beliefs, their experiences.
These are the men who wrote the Constitution. These are the men who created the federal system. In every way, they are totally fundamental to what American politics looks like today.
It all goes back to this extraordinary group of men.
Yeah, and they have rip-roaring yarns as well, let me tell you. So if you want to know why America is the way it is and who the men were who made it, you can listen by searching Empire wherever you get your podcasts.